chair of this session to make sure you're in the right one. This is session 119, entitled, Does the Word of Wisdom Make a Difference? Practical Reasons for Living the Mormon's Health Law. Our presenter this morning will be Dr. Joseph L. Lyon. Dr. Lyon is a professor in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of Utah Medical School. He's a native of Salt Lake City, obtained his MD degree from the University of Utah, and then a master's in public health at Harvard University. He's published over 60 articles in various medical publications. He has a hearty interest in the effects of the environment and lifestyle on medical problems. He's also published papers on Mormon and non-Mormon cancer risks. He's also been very involved in studies regarding the cancer rates among inhabitants of southern Utah. In addition, he's testified in some of those cases as an expert witness and has also testified on the subject at various congressional hearings. He's married and has 6 children, and we greatly appreciate his willingness to come this morning and be a presenter for us. At the conclusion of his remarks, we will have a rebuttal, comments by Dr. Lee Smith. Dr. Smith is an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Utah. He is also medical director of the Stress Medicine Program. He obtained his MD degree from the University of California, San Francisco, and did his residency here at the University of Utah. He's written articles and given papers on the history of Mormon medicine and also on Jesus healing methods. He's a native of Ogden, is married, and has 5 children. He's also past president of the Escalapium. I'm glad he helped me with that one. This is an organization concerning the interface between religious thought and medicine. So as you can see, both of these men are highly qualified to be here with us this morning, so we turn the time to them. At the end of their presentations, we'll have some time for some questions.
Thank you for that introduction. Good morning. I suspect only either the health conscious or the neurotic are here at this hour. Let me make some general comments about health codes. I do not intend to be comprehensive or detailed, but just simply general in nature. Health codes have been part of religious bodies or incorporated into religious belief for a very long time. One only has to go back and read in detail the Law of Moses with its many, many detailed provisions for health to realize that the idea of incorporating practices that were thought to promote health or to benefit individuals was very common. Any of you who know the Law of Moses realize that it covered far more than just simple dietary laws. I was intrigued to find all kinds of dietary information about general sanitation, that latrines were to be put outside the camp, that human waste was to be long separated from water supply and so forth. Very, very practical and usable things. It's interesting also that the first experiment that I'm aware of where anybody made an effort to try to observe the effects of health on in human beings is recorded in the Bible in the account of Daniel being one of the captives taken into Babylon, one of those who was, of course, of high rank from Israel. He and his colleagues were faced with a conflict of having to eat food that was obviously not was not acceptable within their religious belief. And if you're aware, they protested, and their protest led to what would be called a controlled experiment, though not a really true clinical trial. I suspect randomization into treatment groups was not yet quite far advanced. But they were permitted to eat their diet for a period of time, and then evaluated by the king, by one of the king's employees, and it was concluded that their health was improved over what had been when they were attempting to eat the non-acceptable diet, and as a result, Daniel was able to then convince the Babylonians to permit the Jewish people to pursue their separate dietary practices. I've always been intrigued by that as an example of a medical or of a religious practice that was thought to benefit health directly. Coming down to the to our modern time. All of you are aware of the word of wisdom when given in February of 1832. I'm not going to go into the background or reasons for it. There certainly were many the groups in the United States conscious and concerned about health practices. The word of wisdom as it was given, as you know, was given as advice rather than as a commandment. It was given as counsel. It defined several areas, and those areas that were not directly defined, such as hot drinks, were defined fairly shortly thereafter as being tea and coffee. Certainly there were some very clear prohibitions on both the use of alcohol and tobacco. Now, in looking over the recorded course of the history of the word of wisdom, we find that it was not lived with any degree of rigor through the 1840s and in the 1850s. One of the interesting things I would noted was instructions to emigrants from Europe. They were told to bring their own tea and coffee and tobacco if they wanted such. The church wasn't going to provide it for them, but the church certainly wasn't discouraging its use either. I still remember one of Leonard Arrington's delightful little inserts from a letter sent out to bishops for men who were volunteering for volunteer work in building the LDS Temple in the center of Salt Lake. The general authority was castigating the bishops for sending employees down there without an adequate supply of tobacco. And these men were coming down to work and then taking off to go buy their tobacco, and they were not putting in a full day. And this brother was telling these bishops, if you're going to send smokers down here, you send them with enough tobacco so we don't have to have them taking off from work. He was a little annoyed. It was really near the turn of the century when the church began to reemphasize the word of wisdom as a health commandment. And for a long period of time, it was an emphasis rather than a requirement for certain church activities, specifically going to the temple. Church leaders were first encouraged to live it, and then it was extended out, but to general membership. But my father used to comment about his father, who was the first bishop of the Ensign Ward here in Salt Lake City, and happened to be the bishop to President Grant. And in about 1920 or 21, a very prominent member of the ward came in seeking a temple recommend, who happened to be a heavy smoker. And my grandfather, in somewhat of a quandary, posed the question to President Grant, should I or should I not grant him a temple recommend? And President Grant's comment was, can't keep a man out of the temple for smoking. And so we obviously have a shift in emphasis. At that point in time, church leaders were expected to maintain be non-smokers, but members were not. Now, by the 1930s, the requirement for temple recommend included living all the precepts of the word of wisdom. So this meant that the concept was now extended to all church members, and compliance was expected. One of the things that I'll comment a little bit later, but I want to just lay the groundwork for what this meant was that we have had in Utah a large number of people who are LDS who picked up smoking habits, particularly during and after the First World War. And the result of that is we've got a generation in their 60s and 70s now, as they've aged, many of them who are both smokers or ex-smokers. They're particularly among men, much more so among men than women, showing, I think, a fairly strong societal practice that was prevalent during that time. Now, let me also comment quickly on some of the substances involved in the word of wisdom and some of our practices. And first I want to comment quickly on health, on diet. As far as we've been able to determine, the dietary portions of the word of wisdom have not been very well defined, nor have they created as unique a situation as we have with the alcohol, tobacco, coffee, and tea. Based on studies we've done where we randomly select people from the state, for adults from the population of the state of Utah, and interview them for various health practices, we cannot identify what we would say a unique Mormon dietary practice. In other words, Mormons appear to eat about the same kinds of foods in about the same amounts. We don't see any excess of whole grain use, which is one area you might expect to see. Now, some of this so whatever differences there are in dietary standpoint, they're not particularly large or identifiable. The only thing that we found different between Mormons and non-Mormons is Mormons do tend to have a lower caloric intake, but that's primarily explained by the fact that they drink much less alcohol or no alcohol at all. Alcohol is a very calorie-rich food. If you will, think of it as a food. It's very calorie-rich. It ranks up there with fat in terms of the number of calories per gram, and consequently, people who don't drink generally do have a lower caloric intake than people who do. But one brief aside on that, in spite of all the stories you hear about Mormons making up for their lack of addiction to coffee, tea, and for lack of addiction to alcohol or tobacco by eating Snellgrove's ice cream, the Utahns consistently over the last few years, when the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta have been carrying out surveys, have had are the leanest people in the United States. They have the smallest number of people overweight of all the states surveyed. West Virginia is the record leader. I have no idea why, but West Virginia is. We have done some estimation of that based on religion, and again, we don't see much difference. But the Mormons do tend to be a bit on the leaner side. That, in some ways, is rather remarkable, particularly for women, because women. As pregnancies increase, women's weight usually moves up, and the larger number of pregnancies among Mormon women would almost favor that, put them in the other category. So I want to basically set aside dietary components because I don't think they haven't been terribly productive, but they haven't defined two separate very subgroups of in terms of their disease risk. Now, let me talk very quickly about the different substances and also comment about compliance with them. That's been an issue that comes up, and I want to show an overhead that would give you some idea. Hopefully you can all read that. This information comes from survey data that we obtained by interview. Our techniques, for any of you who have a training or interest in sociology, is to use what is known as random digit dialing, where we obtain our subjects via randomly selecting telephone numbers within the state. And we do this for people under 65. For those over 65, we select randomly from the rolls of the Medicare, and as a result, we're able to get what we consider a random, a valid sample of adults living in the state of Utah. Now, what I've shown here are data on current people who report being current smokers of cigarettes, classified by religion, calling everybody who's not LDS, non-LDS. This groups together all the other religious bodies in the state. And then showing the LDS here, my secretary should have extended the line over there just a bit. This is the LDS column here. And then I've shown these people's self-declared status of their religion, whether they are active. We defined active as reporting attending church at more than once a month. And inactive is attending church less than once a month. Now, in terms of tobacco usage, recurrent smoking, we found that about 35% of non-LDS adults report being regular users of tobacco in the form of cigarettes. 10% of total LDS. Now, this is distributed among quite differently. Active LDS, a very tiny fraction, report using tobacco at all, where about 27% of the inactive report use of tobacco. For women, the numbers are very close to the male numbers. And we see, the same spread between the active and the inactive. I haven't, obviously there are a lot of other ways you can compare tobacco. If we had shown this by, not by current cigarette smokers, but by what we call ever smoked, which really is defined from scientific purposes as having a lifetime smoking record of at least 20 packs of cigarettes, we would see more LDS men, particularly in the older ages, reporting having been having smoked sometime in the past. There are a lot more ex-smokers among the LDS males. And as I said, this partly goes back to this compliance question with the word of wisdom, particularly in the early part of this century. My guess is as that older generation dies out, the number of ex-smokers among the LDS will decline quite a bit. Now, let me just also comment quickly about tobacco. Tobacco is, as you know, of course, is a natural product. It was one of the plants indigenous to America and has been rapidly became an important export out of the United States to Europe after the discovery of America. There are, in burning tobacco that people take in their lungs, a very substantial number of chemicals that cause cancer. Not all of them have even been characterized to this day, but there are a large number of chemicals produced within tobacco that are known to cause cancer. Now, if we look at regular alcohol use, that is people who report regular using alcohol, which means at least a drink a week, we again find a very definite difference between the LDS and the non-LDS. About, again, somewhere between 60 to 64% of men and women who are not LDS in Utah report using alcohol on a regular basis, where the numbers of LDS who report using alcohol on a regular basis are substantially lower. And again, we see this split between the active and the inactive LDS. A couple of things that are interesting. One is that even the inactive are not reaching the levels of the non-LDS in their usage. The other thing here is that these values for the non-LDS are fairly close to those values you would find in other areas of the United States. These tend to be levels that are about what citizens living in other area states in the U.S. or the general U.S. population would report as the regular uses of these substances. Now, coffee usage, again, coming from our survey data, shows a larger proportion of people reporting regular use of coffee. As you can see, the LDS are somewhere in the 40%. Now, this is, by the way, ever used, not current. And I did not have the time to extract out the data on what people who are current users. So this percentage will be a bit higher, or a bit lower if we just looked at current usage. There are a lot of, again, ex-coffee drinkers among LDS. These percents here for non-LDS are about 10 to 15% lower than that which we'd find in other areas of the United States. Most areas of the United States, about anywhere from 85 to 95% of the adult population report being regular users of coffee. This surprised me a little bit that it's a bit lower here in Utah. Again, it may be partly a function of being a little less socially acceptable. I don't have any data on tea. Tea is used quite much less commonly. I suspect as our English population migrants have died off, we don't find very many people reporting regular usage of tea. But this gives you some idea of current use of these substances by religious status within the state of Utah. Now, one question that can be raised is, gee, maybe people are misreporting their smoking history. Anyway, or coffee, because of the way you ask your questions. We also, there are two things I'd say on that. One, we've also verified against state tax data, and we find we're pretty close in what we get versus what the state, what people pay tax on, which is not a bad measure of validation. The other thing that's very puzzling is when we ask people their religious status as adults, we get consistently 75% of adults in this state telling us they're LDS. The church only counts 68% on their records. I have no idea where the other 7% come from. But we have now probably surveyed 6,000 or 7,000 people over the last 15 years, and we consistently hit 75% in terms of people who, when we ask them their religious preference, who tell us they're LDS. So we, and we always ask the alcohol, tobacco questions well in advance of asking the religious preference questions. So we don't try to set up people up to give us an answer we want. Now let me make a make some comments about the practical effects of this in terms of health, because that's really the substance of this talk. We have, over the last 20 years, using two resources, several resources. First, the Utah Cancer Registry, which is a database that contains all the names of every individual in the state who have had cancer, and the membership records of the LDS Church, linked these records together to estimate the number, to calculate the number of people in Utah who are LDS and then what their risk of cancer is. We've also used the other databases, primarily the death record, the birth and death records of the state of Utah, and done similar record linkages. And what I want to present now is just some of the information, and this slide is very busy, and I will go through it step at a time for you, so let me do that. In terms of the cancer risk, this data is based on 10 years of cancer risk from 1966 to 1975, and the format is standard. This 100 line is that risk that would occur if the risk of the average citizen of the United States had applied to Utah. So any time one of these bars reaches 100, it means that they are experiencing cancer risk essentially identical to any citizens living elsewhere in the United States. The data have been standardized for age, which basically means that you can't attribute differences to differences in age. Now, overall, let's just start with all forms of cancer, excluding cancer of the skin. The non-LDS in Utah have experienced rates of cancer about equivalent to that seen in other areas of the United States. In other words, for men, they're touching the line, and women, it's actually slightly higher. The non-LDS. The LDS have consistently had all forms of cancer about 25% below that experienced by other citizens of the United States. So we can see that bar coming out to about the 0.75 line here. Now this is taking all LDS regardless of their religious compliance. So we know that this population is not a true non-smoking population, but rather has a proportion of smokers in it among the LDS. Now, let me just run down here and mention this. We cancer sites that are associated with smoking, increases the risk by at least two times, are the oral cavity, the larynx, or voice box, the lung, the esophagus, and the bladder. The first ones are, and it's fairly obvious, the tobacco smoke is touching the lining surface of the body and deposited there. These others, primarily the esophagus, probably comes from the clearance of sputum out of the lung being swallowed, which contains tobacco products. And the bladder comes from metabolic products. We see the LDS for all sites running just for men and women, both running a little less than half of the U.S., where the non-LDS are again up to the U.S. or higher. The most striking difference among them is really the esophagus, where the LDS are down in the order of about 25% of the United States rates. The esophagus also has a strong association with alcohol, so there's a double effect, probably a double beneficial effect here for LDS. Lung, which constitutes probably the single largest number of cases here, again, LDS are running at about 30 to 35% of the risk in the United States. In other words, they're nearly 65 to 75% below the U.S. in terms of their risk of lung cancer. For cancers not generally associated with tobacco, gastrointestinal cancers, particularly colon cancer, which we spent a lot of time studying, which we still don't understand thoroughly. The LDS, again, are well below the non-LDS, and yet we have not been able to pick up good, solid dietary reasons why. This was one of our original ideas, that we would see some fairly dramatic dietary differences. The only explanation I've heard offered that makes sense is that it may well be coffee. That doesn't give coffee drinkers a lot of comfort. But we have a finding both from our studies and from Seventh-day Adventists that suggest coffee may be one of the major explanations for this. Now, for reproductive sites, that is for organs that are involved in reproduction, prostate cancer is about U.S. average for LDS and slightly higher in the non-LDS. And again, we do not have any good explanation for this. There appears to be no effect of tobacco or alcohol, and reproductive factors, and both reproductive and sexual factors, do not appear to play a role. And we've also studied this in detail in diet and haven't found much. So it's a very frustrating thing to study in terms of risk. For the women in the room, LDS enjoy a substantial benefit in terms of breast cancer risk. About half of that can be explained by the earlier age at first pregnancy among LDS women. But the residual cannot. There's been recent work suggesting that alcohol contributes a small but significant risk to breast cancer. And this may be the direct explanation, that coupled with the lower age at first pregnancy, for the lower breast cancer risk among LDS women. The site that stands out as having the largest difference is cancer of the uterine cervix. If we only showed the invasive form of this, if we showed the in situ form, which is the earlier premalignant, we would have even a more striking difference. When we first made this observation, there was virtually no evidence that it was a smoking-related site. Since that time, there have been at least 15 studies that I'm aware of that have implicated cigarette smoking as a causal factor in this. And you may think, how can this happen? Basically, tobacco products are absorbed into the body and then secreted in virtually all of the mucus, all of the organs in the body that have mucous membrane surfaces, and so they're secreted in the vagina, both in the uterine from the uterine cavity and in the vaginal fluid. So there is a direct exposure to tobacco products. There's also a second factor there, which of course is the viral factor from promiscuous sexual intercourse. And the smoking and the promiscuity are lower in the LDS compared to non-LDS. I think that's enough on this, and my time's getting short, so let me press on. We have also done, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail, opportunity to look at risk by compliance within the church. We've done this by looking at priesthood level for men. And there's also a parallel study by Dr. James Enstrom at UCLA, who looked at 12,000 high priests in the 70s living in California. Our results are amazingly congruent. Basically, high priests in the 70s have mortality rates about half of that which one would expect if we're Californians. That's who he used as his comparison group. We concur with that. All of the smoking-associated sites in high priests in the 70s are extraordinarily low, approaching about 10% of the U.S. rate, suggesting that almost all of the cause of these cancers are tobacco-related. Enstrom study in California has defined an extraordinarily healthy group of people, but I don't think they're pre-selected. I think it was based on lifestyle and from the Word of Wisdom. Now, other studies that we have carried out that might be of some passing interest to you, and then I'll conclude and let Dr. Smith have at it. We've also looked at heart disease mortality in the state of Utah. Tobacco is associated with heart disease mortality, and we expected there would be some differences. The differences are very striking. The LDS in Utah have about 30 to 35% less heart disease mortality than the non-LDS. Enstrom's finding in California for active LDS was over 50. It was over a 50% reduction. Again, a very striking finding. It is far in excess of that which can be explained by tobacco use alone. And there is a paradoxical part here that still has not been explained, and Dr. Smith, maybe you want to comment on this, but there are several large studies that found that moderate use of alcohol actually protects against heart disease. And here you have a population who generally are not even moderate users of alcohol, who are running rates well below that found in other areas of the U.S. So that to me is quite paradoxical. I have not seen any explanation of it. Some of them at stroke and found very little difference. Stroke is not nearly as strongly associated with tobacco and alcohol usage. We have also looked at cirrhosis of the liver. Now, cirrhosis of the liver is a pretty good marker for alcoholism, and again find Utahns LDS running between about 50-60% of the United States, where non-LDS are right up at about U.S. average, again suggesting that there is some very different protective effect from abstaining from alcohol. Two other studies to mention. One, we looked at the mortality of infants in the first 28 days of life. Utah, for a very long time, has had the lowest infant mortality rates in the United States, or neonatal mortality rates. That's been observed for a very long period of time. We wondered what the effect would be on LDS, what the effect of LDS was on this. And what we found was that active LDS were reporting the lowest rates. The non-Mormons were up higher than the LDS, like about two times higher. When we adjusted for birth weight, which is primarily influenced by tobacco usage, most of the difference for the LDS, for the non-LDS, disappeared. The inactive LDS still persisted as the highest risk group in the state. I don't know why, but they still show up as the highest LDS group. And perhaps ending this sort of horror story of human disease on a lighter note, for those of you who are concerned about your appearance, we just recently finished a paper on wrinkling. People have commented for some time that smokers appear to be more wrinkled than non-smokers. Now, we did not break it down by religious body, but we used LDS people as primarily a control group. And we find that even after adjusting for sunlight exposure, which is a very powerful factor in aging skin, wrinkling among smokers are about 3 to 4 times more likely to be wrinkled than non-smokers, and it appears to be quite equal among men and women. So in conclusion, let me offer the following observations. Compliance with the Word of Wisdom is something that really is an early 20th century phenomenon, and we still have within the LDS population a group that are seen having some of the deleterious benefits of not complying, primarily among elderly men. We see variable compliance with the Word of Wisdom, tobacco obviously being the one that's most avoided, and coffee the least. We see very substantial health, direct benefits in health. Enstrom, based on his studies, estimated the LDS gained about 7 years extra life expectancy. In other words, their life expectancy was about 7 years long, for men was about 7 years longer than other citizens of the United States, for women about 4 years longer, a very practical benefit. My guess is over time, as other people begin to adopt, for health reasons, many of the Word of Wisdom practices, particularly alcohol and tobacco, their longevity will probably increase toward that of the LDS. Finally, I have to comment that there seems to be a lot of wisdom in the Word of Wisdom. It has certainly spared many people who follow its precepts the health problems that have occurred in the early 20th century from exposure to these substances. Thank you.
Turn that back on. I have for many years followed Dr. Lyon's work because I don't know how many of you know this, but he's made some very substantial contributions to America's health by these studies. Let me just go through a quick summary, if I may, of some of the things he said, because these studies he's given you, these ups and downs that he's summarized, have a lot of great statistical validity. They've looked at them very carefully scientifically, and I endorse his studies. What I'd like to do in my comments is take a look at some of the other sides beyond just those tests of faith part of the word of wisdom, that is smoking, alcohol, and the like. Let's sit just for a second, though. I remember back about the time I was going into practice seeing one of his studies that said Utah rates of mortality and cancer, cardiovascular disease, and overall was less in Utah than in the U.S. And my immediate question was, well, what does that mean? Maybe it's just, you know, more farmers and not so many city people or something. Is it really LDS? And about the time I was asking the question, he had all the data for the next studies which said that the LDS rates were less than non-LDS, as you've seen, that the Utah non-LDS rates were somewhat greater than U.S., not much, but he described that, that active LDS people have rates that are lower than inactive, and that the inactive LDS rates are actually a little higher than the non-LDS people in Utah, and that it varies according to different types of cancer. That might be worth just a comment. well, in the interest of time, I won't comment on that just yet. Well, maybe I will. Just one thing. He mentioned prostate cancer being a little higher in LDS males, active LDS males. One might wonder about that. That really is an interesting finding. The only things that I'm aware of that contribute, and there are probably many more, that contribute to prostate cancer are things like the human papillomavirus, which can be passed sexually, testosterone levels, that is higher levels of male hormone, tend to lead to more prostate cancer. And let's see. Well, I can't remember. There's one other factor. It doesn't make sense. Oh, vasectomy. Yeah, vasectomy. And LDS men, I think, at least based on my experience, have fewer vasectomies, probably have a little lower sexual experience. We might wonder about testosterone levels. The only way I can make a connection there, there are some interesting studies, and I don't know what you want to read into this. There's some interesting studies on the effect of type A behavior on testosterone levels. And type A men who are a little bit on the hostile side run lower testosterone levels. And when you treat the type A, those levels go back up. Now, that's pure speculation. And then Enstrom studies, which also suggested that adding exercise and adequate sleep further improved this rate difference in LDS people and non-LDS, and he said something interesting. These are the California studies, that the LDS rates are just a little bit better than non-Mormon but Mormon-like non-LDS. That is, churchgoers who don't smoke. They're just the Mormons, active Mormons, are a little better than those, and that the Mormon-like non-LDS rates were significantly lower than the U.S. in general. My questions about all of this has to do with a much broader context, and I think in a theological symposium, some of the things I'm going to say are pertinent. Factors other than the usual four tests of faith of the Word of Wisdom. Diet, Lynn has talked about that a little bit. There may be some dietary differences. LDS people and Seventh-day Adventists have been compared, and Seventh-day Adventists tend to eat less protein, more vegetarian than we are, and have lower rates, but also follow basically the same kind of four principles of the Word of Wisdom, because you see their church came out of the same historical period that ours did. If we have time, it'd be really interesting to look at that historical period as to where did the Word of Wisdom come from and why did the Seventh-day Adventists have basically the same kind of notions. It relates greatly to what was going on at the time the Word of Wisdom came out, a movement called Popular Health Reform, which was promoted by Sylvester Graham, of Graham Cracker fame, who basically, and it was sweeping the United States. There are a lot of interesting reasons for this. Historically, there was a reaction to the old orthodox medicine, which was bad medicine, you know, the bleeding and giving calomel and things to purge you for all diseases. And everybody was reacting to that and saying, if you can't trust the practitioners, how do we prevent disease? And it was tied in religiously. Sylvester Graham was a minister. And particularly in Ohio, where the Mormons were, the popular health reform movement was in the air. The tenets of popular health reform were eat lots of grains, less Graham cereals and Graham crackers and the like. The whole cereal industry came out of popular health reform. Eat lots of grains, eat little meat. Sylvester Graham said meat is the cause of sexual licentiousness and tuberculosis. Don't eat meat. And the five poisons of popular health reform were coffee, tea, alcohol, tobacco, and opium. Those were the questions in the air. Temperance movement was caught up in all of this. And I think that those questions were even more important than the men spitting on the floor in the Newell Whitney store as to the things that came out. Joseph was asking the Lord. Incidentally, there were a lot more tenets of popular health reform than those that are in the Word of Wisdom, and they were not endorsed by the Lord. And it turns out that they were some pretty bad ones. Graham himself died of malnutrition. Okay. But the ones that were endorsed, I think Lynn is showing you, have some very valid wisdom and are being proven to be very useful. But there's some interesting things in that word of wisdom. I'm going to leave the last part of this and skip down in the interest of time for a minute to a little comment in the word of wisdom. We'll come back to this slide. Opium. Right. And opium was left out. I'm glad it was, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to take painkillers when we need them. Okay, but it does imply, you know, narcotic, drug addiction kind of problems. Nevertheless, the Lord didn't endorse that one totally. Doctrine and covenants. If we get down to the end where the promises are about health, notice this. I think that this is useful to take note of, that there are two parts of the qualifiers for those promises. All saints who remember to keep and do these sayings, that's the usual things of the word of wisdom, walking in obedience to the commandments, shall receive health in their navel and marrow to their bones, find wisdom, knowledge, run and not be weary, destroying angels and pass them by. And there's two parts to that. One is keeping the tenets of the word of wisdom, and the other is walking in obedience to the commandments. This is borrowed from the Old Testament. This is a recapitulation of Proverbs in chapter 3, that phrase, health in their navel, marrow in their bones. Proverbs begins, incidentally, before I read this little part, in the first chapter, he says, this book that I'm giving you is to give you wisdom. And wisdom is to live my commandments, which are righteousness, okay, wisdom, righteousness, integrity, justice. And he says, this is to show you how to live with righteousness, justice, integrity. Okay, and then the whole book's about that. And down in chapter 3, let me read this little section a little more than the point I want to make. My son, forget not my law. Let thine heart keep my commandments. Remember, the commandments that Proverbs is emphasizing are integrity, righteousness, doing justice, and mercy is brought in there in another place in Proverbs. For length of days and long life and peace shall they, keeping the commandments, add unto thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them on the tablet of thy heart. Trust in the Lord with all thy heart. See, trust is a faith. Okay, so faith, mercy, truth, righteousness, integrity will lengthen your days. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Respect or revere the Lord and depart from evil. It shall be health to thy navel and marrow to thy bones. Now, the other translations, this last phrase, I'm just going to take that last little phrase, the health of the navel, marrow, and the bones, the promise of the word of wisdom. New English Bible lets that read, let that is keeping these commandments of God, righteousness, integrity, truth, mercy, let that be the medicine to keep you in health, the liniment for thy limbs. That's the same phrase as this health to thy navel, marrow to thy bones translated. In the New Jerusalem Bible, health giving this to your body, relief to your bones. All right, now, given that thought, there's a part here that we don't think of in the Word of Wisdom. It's not just those tests of faith, but it has to do with this whole idea of what God is trying to get us to become at the bottom line. People of integrity, people of loving kindness and mercy, people who have this sense of hope and faith. Okay? Now, if we were to make a couple more connections. Let me come back to that first little overhead. I think we have time to look at this and then a couple of slides. There are some other things other than just those tests. Now, mind you, I think it's the points that Dr. Lyons made about tobacco, about alcohol and caffeine are very valid. They are carcinogenic. They are risk factors for heart disease. But there's some other things that activate them as risk factors, and they tie into this notion of these overall commandments, and that's what I want to get at. For example, social connectedness. There was a fascinating study back in Roseto, Pennsylvania, in which health statistics showed that this little community, which people kind of tended to stay in, had a very low incidence of heart disease and strokes. And so a team from Berkeley went back and wanted to find out what's going on here so we can export this to the rest of the country. They expect to go in and find people, you know, jogging and slim and not smoking and all those eating vegetables, all those things we usually talk about, and found, interestingly enough, almost the opposite. This was a little Italian community where people that were their generations, it's kind of stayed around. And they found out that, by and large, many of them were kind of overweight, and they were not very physically active, and there was some smoking going on. And so they said, what's going on here? And they tried to figure out all the factors. They studied the people in the community who had low heart disease rates and high rates to see what's the difference between them in that community. And the bottom line came out was their social connectedness. They had multiple generations of families. There was always somebody there that cared about them. They felt loved. They felt part of things. But basically, it was this strong family structure. And there's a whole body of research suggesting that people who feel cared about and who care have much lower incidence rates of heart disease and of cancer. The person that goes home with his heart attack to a dog or to somebody at home does much better than someone that goes home alone. So do some of these factors in active LDS people, of social connectedness, caring, feeling loved, is that, how important is that? Is a very important question, I think. We might look at education levels. LDS tend to be a little higher in education, and more educated people have lesser heart and cancer incidence generally. We've talked about sexual promiscuity. I'd like to finish up with some notions about the idea of stress. What I'm saying with all this is a broad notion that looking at it only from the standpoint of tobacco causing disease is like one of our old medical models, that there's something out there, a cause, that is coming in and causing us to be sick. You know, the germ gets in and it makes you ill. It goes well beyond that. We became a little more sophisticated a few decades ago when we started looking at the idea of host resistance. Some people that have these things out there that are affecting you get sick and some don't. And what's the difference? What makes up this host resistance to some of these factors? Some of those that have been documented have been things like this, social. For example, the little study that I just described from Roseto, organic and genetic factors are involved in host resistance. And this one right here, a coping style, becomes very important. How does one deal with the problems of life? Let me I wanted to talk about that, but we won't have time. Let me show you a study that illustrates this point. I think it's a fascinating study. A fellow named Grossarth Matacek went into a little village in Yugoslavia that people tend to stay around year after year, went to every other house in middle-aged people and studied their style of dealing with the problems of life. Remember the gospel? Things that the Lord is teaching us, his commandments about integrity, about loving kindness, about hope and trust, okay? Those things are ways to deal with life. They are his way of maturely, with wisdom, dealing with the problems of life. This little study categorized people into four categories. One were people who felt hopeless and helpless. They felt like victims. They blamed everything out there for making them miserable. That's one way of dealing with problems. It became hostile sometimes. A second group were those that were more hostile and aggressive. They were kind of angry most of the time, doing a lot of blaming. Third group were kind of like most of us. They sort of used a lot of different things, nothing too striking. And a fourth group were those that basically dealt with things in a mature, adaptive, you know, make lemonade out of lemons kind of way of life. And then he followed them for 10 years with two diseases in mind, the two that Lynn has addressed, cancer and cardiovascular disease. I'm going to bypass. Well, let me mention just one thing here, okay? There's a 15-year study at Duke regarding the effects of hostility on your health outcomes. Those that were hostile, who had high mistrustfulness, blaming, angry about things, had 40% earlier death rate than those that were more trusting. Utah is thought to be, the capital of scams. We're a very trusting people, right? Well, maybe we're naive and we lose a lot of money, but there might be benefits from being trusting, okay? And of course, and again, alienated social support may enter into that, but this may be a factor, you see, in some of those things. Now, let's come back to that Grossarth Matacek study. This is for cancer. Type 1 are the hopeless, helpless people. Type 2 are the hostile, aggressive people. 3 are the kind of the mixture, and type 4 is the mature, adaptive. Following these middle-aged people for 10 years, their incidence of cancer, the red bar, is those that face a lot of situational stress. The blue does not have a lot of situational stress, but still feel that hopeless, helpless style. Notice where the cancer people were. They're all in the hopeless, helpless group. On the other hand, if you look at cardiovascular disease on the next slide, they're nearly all in the hostile, aggressive group. Now, he said, you know, one of the problems you have with epidemiological studies like this is cause and effect. These are associations. Does tobacco cause it, or is it that it's related to a lot of other things in one's life that causes the problem? So let me give you an illustration. There was a tongue-in-cheek study done many years ago in which a guy showed that people who wore pocket watches had much more heart attacks than those that wear wristwatches. Well, you know, older guys, pocket watch. So the idea was, don't wear a pocket watch, right? There's an old saying that says, most people die in bed, so keep the patient out of bed. So, you know, cause and effect and associations are a bit of a problem. So what you have to do is see if you can change the effect. And incidentally, this work that Dr. Lyons has done about showing likelihood of tobacco and of even caffeine now has changed. It's been a very powerful influence on changing America's lifestyles. I hope you appreciate the work that he's done. Well, Matacek and a guy from Heidelberg went over to Heidelberg with another researcher, and they wanted to see if they could change those styles of dealing with the problems of life and if it affected cancer and heart disease. And they had a program, it was a fairly long program, to try and change this hopeless, helpless feeling or the hostile aggressives. They took people that were in the high-risk groups. And this was the result. Following them up for 13 years, again, middle-aged people at risk with those two at-risk types of styles. And in essence, I won't go through the details, they were able to cut in half the incidence, in this case, of cancer and in this case, cardiovascular disease, to cut more than half by changing these styles. Keeping the commandments, the Lord tells us, will solve the problems of dealing with the problems of life. Now, let me, I can't give you any of the data on this, but quickly run through what we have studied as what the real key issues to stress resilience is all about. And you'll find some interesting things here, I think. These are four stress resilient components. One is caring love. A number of studies now that show that the parlance in this field that's used is creative altruism or social interest. People who are caring about something outside themselves that they're contributing to and bringing to pass are become more stress resilient. I won't go through the studies that illustrate that, but feeling that their life is worthwhile. Secondly, integrity, being true to one's deepest core values. It's important to note core values. Things like love and honesty and deep things. Responsible free will, that a person feels that he has some effect on making happen in his life what he wants to have happen. Free agency, we call that. And that they're growth-oriented. They enjoy the challenges of life. A creative challenge to see what I can do with this rather than feeling like it's a big monkey on my back. Now, you know, that's that eternal progression kind of notion. If one these are the principles that decrease this stress response, that give people this, these are the characteristics of people who are studied that have that mature, adaptive style that creates low incidence of heart disease, or it's associated with low incidence of heart disease, low incidence of cancer. The question that I have, and incidentally, it's worth taking, I think, 30 seconds on one other slide. This was addressed the other night in the symposium on what are the most important principles of the law that Jesus said, you omit the weightier matters. Once made a little study of what I've called summary verses. If you go through the scriptures, there are a number of these where the Lord talks about, that's fine, leave that off. Where the Lord talks about, you know, it's great for you to be involved in your rituals and all the sacrifices and all these things you're doing, but what I really want is, and this is what they are, and they all come up the same things, to do justice, mercy, to walk humble, righteousness, loving kindness. I won't go through the etiology of that, but there are about four words that all of the prophets in all of the different scriptures keep saying the same things. This is what I really want. These are the commandments. This is the bottom line. It's the difference between the means and the ends in religion. This is the ends that everything we do, in my mind, is designed to bring us to. And interestingly enough, when you look at the Greek and Hebrew meanings that are translated this way, it's the same things as those things, as the stress-resilient principles. Caring love, the loving kindness. Justice has a lot to do with natural consequences of your choices, being able to make to be in control of your life, responsible free will to bring about natural consequences of your choices. Okay, integrity. Okay, same things. They are these stress resilient principles. And one of the great studies, in my mind, would be to take a look at and see if we, as active LDS people, if the church is achieving this or not. Is it just the coffee and tobacco, which I think is a very important part, or are we able to achieve the ends as well or better than other approaches that the Lord is really after? Thanks.